Tested live. Catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.
A very close correlation and an intersection between luxury goods and financial crimes. Now, many of us have been seeing the TikToks and the posts around how many of the luxury goods that we buy are actually made in China. Don't be surprised. That's just because China has the people, the machine, the scale, the time, the resources to actually make these brands at scale before they then go out to get the final stamp of approval within their unique territories or regions of design. But beyond that, we've often heard of some of the scams where individuals get money paid as a bribe through luxury bags, through luxury items that can carry such containers, and sometimes even gifting people these luxury bags. If I'm not mistaken, I'm already thinking about the time of the state capture inquiry and certain claims that were made there specific to Mamnomvula Mokonyane, who currently serves as the General Secretary General, Deputy of the ANC. But what's the link? And Mobulawa, if you don't get the salary increase on your payslip, are you looking to get a luxury handbag as a payment? Well, this is hopefully going to answer your question, but most importantly, also help you connect the dots. We're joined now on the line by one of my favorite guests who often helps us with these complex themes and stories, is Stephen Powell, head of ENS Africa's forensic practice, to help us understand how there's a very close link between money laundering risks associated with luxury goods. Mr. Powell, such a pleasure to speak to you, sir.
As always, Gugu, thanks so much for having me. Great to be here. Thank you.
Fantastic. I'm really excited to have this conversation. And I believe, as you heard from one of our listeners, Mobulawa, the reality of understanding the link between luxury goods as well as, money laundering is very close. And it's something that we sometimes might be enticed by because we see it in the movies and hear it in the news headlines. But it's also a reality. Maybe set the scene for us just to understand the intersection between the two.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, before I jump into that, you mentioned the State Capture Commission and some of the evidence that was led. And I recall still the evidence by an electrician who worked for Basaso, who testified that he would install in some electrical equipment at the home of the minister that you referred to.
Yes.
And he saw there was a car in the garage and it was covered with a tarpaulin. And he thought to himself, why would someone cover the car if it's already in the garage? So he said his curiosity got the better of him, and he looked under the car and under the cover, and he saw it was an Aston Martin sports car.
Right.
And so the minister was asked, who paid for this car? And she said, well, I did pay for some of it.
Ah.
And who paid for the balance? And she said, well, I paid 1 million, my lord. And then she said, the car cost 3. And so obviously the judge wanted to know, where did the other 2 come from? And the answer was friends of the family.
Ah,
and then the judge's next line of questioning, or the evidence leader's next line of questioning, so did the family friends happen to benefit from contracts at your department? Mm. And she said, they wanted to be there. I was there, and I kind of helped them to be there because the procurement people were kind of giving them a hard time.
Sure.
So you see, corruption, luxury goods, there's an inextricable link, but you obviously hit the nail on the head. You know, it's all about laundering money, and luxury goods hold distinct allure for all of us. It symbolizes wealth, status, exclusivity, and that goes for cars, exquisite jewelry. People love these items for their craftsmanship and the prestige of the different brands, but behind this facade of our province is a dark reality that there is massive potential for syndicates, money launderers, fraudsters, and others involved in illicit activity to use luxury goods as a way to conceal the origins of illicit funds through high-value purchases.
Exactly. I'm so glad you mentioned that, because even when I think of some of the scams that SARS have been able to track down, it's always a young professional who buys a flashy vehicle, one that actually, you know, is unconventional within the normal market. And we often use the phrase that they're cleaning money. I'm hoping that you can just take us back to just some of the basics of the transaction and how typically, I guess, to the naked, cleaning money can work and be effective through that measure, but ultimately how it still remains wrong, incorrect, and traceable.
Yeah, absolutely. So money laundering to just explain to listeners, is the process of engaging in financial transactions to conceal the identity, source, or destination of illicit funds. And there are three phases. The one is placement. The first phase is introducing cash into the financial system. Mm-hmm. The second we call layering. And layering is a complex set of financial transactions to camouflage the true source of the cash. And then finally, we get to stage three, and that is what we call integration. And this is where the individuals acquire wealth, where they convert through transactions the illicit funds into assets like cars, yachts, luxury watches, artwork. These are all things that can be easily acquired and easily converted into cash when the goods are moved across our borders. So that's how the process of money laundering is done. But a lot of these dealers in high-end luxury goods have got regulatory compliance obligations, Gugu. Mm. They have to do what we call CDD. CDD is what the banks do on all of us. It's customer due diligence. So they have to know their customer. They have to understand what is the source of the funds. And they also have reporting obligations. You know, they have to, if they come across an individual making purchases that is clearly not consistent with their means or income, they have to submit a report to the FIC, to their Financial Intelligence Center, and the FIC in turn will then send that information. They'll do some more data research on the report itself, and then they will send it to the commercial crime units, the DPCI, SARS, or whichever regulatory body is impacted by the activities that they've reported. And it's easy to buy the goods, but it's not that easy to not be reported if you don't have a legitimate source of the funding. Yeah. But this is a vehicle that is used by money launderers all across the globe.
An interesting one. I've also picked up that beneficial ownership is a new level of disclosure that many, if you're a director of any business, it's become a requirement that you actually offer this. Is that part of the remedy to actually ensure that whichever company one might be associated with or director of, there's a clear understanding of, at the end of the day, yes, we can say this money belongs to this business, but who is it going to in terms of a juristic person or natural person rather than a juristic person?
Absolutely. So the beneficial ownership concept is something that was really pushed hard by the State Capture Commission, because we have to understand the true origin or the true parties that are going to benefit from transactions. And the Zondo Commission recommendation, which has been implemented, has seen the CIPC keeping a register of the ultimate beneficial owners of businesses across the board. Yeah. And it's part of the due diligence process. When you onboard a business partner, supplier, or you buy a business, you've got to make sure that you know exactly who you are dealing with. So it's very much part and parcel of anti-corruption compliance, and it's a vital step. So that is something that has been incredibly useful, Gugu. But I couldn't resist also just throwing in my own little just rant about President Trump, because what he's also done recently is, for years, the United States was the most robust enforcer of anti-corruption violation prosecutions. Really? They used to bring enforcement actions against large companies that bribed anywhere across the globe. And in February, the 11th of February, President Trump signed an executive order putting a pause on the U.S. enforcement of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act.
Oh, no.
And they were the global leader. So now it's up to the rest of the world to enforce anti-corruption compliance. He hasn't repealed the statute, but he's just put a pause on enforcement, which is really a negative message to the market and to the world. And the worst thing is that he's actually gone on record saying that he thinks it's a ridiculous law. And he's also said that it impedes the competitiveness of American companies because their foreign counterparties can bribe easily. And that's just wrong.
That is definitely wrong. And I think we also need to understand how far-reaching this is as consumers, because ultimately, any crime that would be committed using the U.S. dollar, if I'm not mistaken, not a cruel crime. In other words, you and I can exchange dollars here in South Africa, but because of the fact that it's U.S. dollars, the U.S. authorities could actually come and arrest us. Is that not, I guess, the principle, and just how far-reaching that
Correct.
Particular
that,
regulation
that is
was?
The principle, Gugu. And what used to happen is the DOJ and JNJ as the Department of Justice in the United States, they would initiate enforcement actions. And we saw the DOJ in action helping South Africa with some of the corruption that unraveled at Eskom. So there was corruption committed by some of the employees at ABB. And when the parent company found out, they put in compliance processes, they remediated, they fixed the problems, and they self-reported to the DOJ in the United States. And with the help of the DOJ, South Africa managed to initiate a settlement where ABB paid, I think the number was just over a billion and a half rand back to Eskom. That would not have taken place without the assistance of the DOJ. Mm. And there have been a number of other high-profile investigations where they have helped South Africa. But many other countries across the globe, you know, we think about the Brazilian car wash scandal a few years ago. The DOJ and United States played a significant role in that. And yeah. What it means now is that they've put this pause on enforcement. And they want to see whether FCPA enforcement is in line with the new policies, which seems to focus on immigration and foreigners that the president believes have committed crimes in the U.S. So the priority in the U.S. seems to have shifted at the moment, which is not good for the rest of the world.
Definitely not good for the rest of the world at all, Mr. Powell. And if I guess it almost seems as though we're protecting those who are already within the flows of illicit financial flows and money laundering to actually continue without any consequence. Yeah. And that raises a lot of concern, especially for someone who might be listening and thinking, well, hold on. I like luxury goods and I've earned my money and I've worked hard for it. And I don't want to find myself getting caught in the loop of perhaps purchasing an item that might have an illicit background. So are there ways of managing that? Because I guess we can't assume anyone with an Aston Martin or with a luxury artwork is actually involved in money laundering, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. So you've got to do a bit of homework on the source that you're buying from to make sure that it is a legitimate business and that you aren't buying the proceeds of crime or an asset that has been tainted. So one of the key messages is make sure that you know who you're dealing with and deal with reputable players. And if something is priced too good to be true, it probably is too good to be true. So use your sense of judgment and we call it savvy, you know, just understanding when you're entering into a dubious transaction. And there are a lot of rogues out there. But I do want to add, you know, we spoke earlier about Trump putting a pause on enforcement. That is not the direction that South Africa is going in because, you know, we've been grey-listed and we've had the State Capture Commission and we've introduced a lot of legal reform. And you spoke about one of them with ultimate beneficial ownership being introduced. But we've also put in a requirement called there's a new Section 34A to the PRECA. And just to explain what PRECA is the Prevention and Combating of Corrupt Activities Act. It requires us to report fraud, theft, extortion, forgery, outrage, or corruption where the value exceeds 100,000 Rand. But we've got a new Section 34A, which requires companies to have adequate procedures to prevent corruption. So it actually forces us to embrace anti-corruption compliance. And that's one of the measures that was also recommended by Judge Zondo. And it's also one of the initiatives to get South Africa, positive news that by October of this year, we hope to have ticked off the last two boxes that we had to achieve in order to be off the grey list. I just wanted to make sure that listeners are aware that corruption is never a good thing. It's unethical. It's wrong. But you will also be prosecuted and punished if you do, irrespective of what Mr. Trump's views on the topic are.
Oh, 100%, yes. If there's anything, this is completely unethical in terms of money laundering. And of course, one does need the rules of the law. Otherwise, you will face the legal consequences of it. What I'm also intrigued by is some international markets. We focus on South Africa as well as the US, but I'm aware that there's certain studies that also reveal further details as to how this is being managed in markets like the UK, China, France, and even a particular threshold that I understand speaks and applies to the EU. Does this have to do with valuations of the luxury goods and how much they're going for?
I think the thresholds are there, and some of the countries across our borders set different thresholds. But what is important to understand is that all dealers of high-value luxury goods, that industry is subject to robust regulation because it is often a vehicle for money launderers to launder their illicit funds. There are onerous reporting obligations on the luxury goods industry. So when it comes to dealers in motor vehicles, yachts, luxury watches, handbags, etc., all of those entities are subject to robust laws and reporting obligations. Mm-hmm. And it is a global problem. So one of the reasons that we were grey-listed is South Africa was found wanting in terms of our own anti-money laundering procedures and controls. We had deficiencies. We had a lack of supervision over some, we refer to it as high-risk industries. And there has been quite a large exposure of some of the corruption by Al Jazeera, the media program. They've done a documentary, a four-part documentary on money laundering in the gold industry.
Yes.
And they've described how gold has been used as a illicit activity and to move funds across borders. And Dubai is one of the regions that is referred to extensively in the documentary, where they expose some of these syndicates that have been operating with impunity, starting with cigarette smuggling out of Zimbabwe and then buying gold and the gold through borders and using refineries, etc., to conceal the source of the funds. So there's a lot that has been going on and a lot that is being done to try and curb this.
You're very right. That definitely doesn't get enough attention in terms of the takes place there, and even significant levels of processing to make sure that there's authentication of the documents as in, and even the product. I'm also keen to ask about crypto, because I understand some of these themes of children getting kidnapped and movement of money,
yeah,
especially cross-border. That's where cryptocurrencies have also come on board as a means to facilitate money laundering.
Absolutely, Gugu. And in the forensic work that we do, we often find crypto being used as the vehicle to conceal the proceeds of crime. And it is another global problem, because all across the world, cryptocurrency has been abused by drug traffickers and fraudulent syndicates. And you'll see in the ransomware attacks, the ransom and hackers always demand to be paid in cryptocurrency. They want Bitcoin or another cryptocurrency. But we have seen a global clampdown on Bitcoin and cryptocurrency, because it is an area that regulators across the globe have recognized there is potential leakage, and it is an opportunity for abuse. So in South Africa, as part of our response to the grey listing, we also brought cryptocurrency under the supervision of the Financial Services Authority, and cryptocurrency is now regulated as a FIS product. You know, so the rules that have come into play, and there is supervision currently in South Africa, and in doing so, we've actually mirrored what has happened in many other jurisdictions across the globe. So it's not that easy. And my favorite example of this is, you know, when the crypto platforms were advertising their product, they would say that, you know, if Gugu, you sit in Cape, a nephew who's in New York, you need to send $200 to your nephew. Yeah. If you try and move those funds, the $200, via a mainstream bank, and they call this the TradFi, you know, the traditional finance routes,
yes,
you're going to fill in 14 forms and it's going to cost you more than the $200 to move those funds. And if you use crypto, you can move $200 literally within minutes with no forms. And the problem with that is you can replace the niece and yourself with a syndicate trying to move funds to another branch of the syndicate in another region. And instead of $200, you can move $1 million. Exactly. And that's how easy it is, you know. So there was a requirement for supervision, and fortunately some of it is in place. It's still not perfect, and there's a lot of mischief that happens in this environment. We use terms such as pump and dump, where the crypto platforms will use influencers to get people to buy into their product, and as soon as the price goes up, they dump their shareholding, and a lot of people lose out. But that's a whole program on itself.
Oh my goodness, Stephen. That's true. You're tickling my brain cells with this particular topic, because there's so much to explore going further. But as you've mentioned, there's so many means, so many avenues we do in place, especially from a South African point of view, to ensure that people are held to account. But as with any crime, sometimes the criminals are a lot smarter, but beyond that, they can also be a lot meaner. And I'm keen to understand, as an attorney and representing the ENS Africa's forensic practice, you know, these sometimes are very dangerous people that you're dealing with. So are we finding that, number one, there's sufficient support from law enforcement to allow for the effective protection of yourself and team members or other investigators in this regard? And just how dangerous is it? Because these are big guys. They hide between, you know, behind screens, but who knows what other influences they might have?
Absolutely. Gugu, you're touching on a discussion my boss often has with me. He's often worried about our safety and protection, because we do sometimes deal with syndicates. We do sometimes have taken appointments to recover assets for the asset forfeiture unit, where we've gone and taken away the sports cars and closed bank accounts of drug dealers. And obviously they're not too happy with the individuals doing these types of things. And when you have to go to court and testify about some of the things that we find, it is high risk, you know. Mm-hmm. So we are careful, we do watch our backs, and we are vigilant at all times, but it is a risk, and it is quite a worrying risk, because we all know one of the liquidators was assassinated not too long ago, you know. So there are bad people out there, and they are hitmen. So there's always risk in this type of work, but we've got to manage it. And someone has to do this work.
100%, someone has to do it. Mr. Powell, we respect you and your team for the amazing work that you do. And most importantly, we appreciate you, you know, bringing us into your world so that we have a better understanding of these often very complex themes that take place when it comes to understanding money laundering, the linkage with luxury goods, and again, you know, understanding the complexities that happen within these transactions. So I guess next time I see an Aston Martin, I'll look at it with a little bit of envy, and I won't judge, but we'll just hope that there's been full disclosure from the driver of the vehicle beforehand.
Thanks so much, Gugu. Great to speak to you. Good evening, listeners.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate your time this evening, sir. That's Stephen Powell, the head of ENS Africa's forensic practice. What an interesting conversation, right? Ooh, yeah, definitely one for us to absorb. And I think one of the biggest takeaways that we also need to be mindful of is, of course, that pause in terms of the legislation that Donald Trump has implemented, just showing again how there's so many moving parts to how it is that he is guiding the White House. And of course, the ripple effects of his pause on the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act enforcement. Whilst he's paused, though, South Africa, as we know, still has very strict requirements in terms of making sure that we're able to identify any money laundering, and not just identify it, but prosecute it adequately too.
If you missed it live, catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.